to reconnoitre the region to find a suitable spot. I felt depressed at the prospect, and to make matters worse, Elsa chose this moment to join us on our way home. Behind her, the cubs were playing happily along the road, and I could not bear to visualize them roaming on the windswept, lava-strewn desert which surrounds the lake. After we reached the camp, we gave the family their supper, which kept them occupied while I arranged the table for our Christmas dinner. I decorated it with flowers and tinsel ornaments, and put the little silver Christmas tree I'd kept from last year in the middle, and a still smaller one, which had just arrived from London, in front of it. By now, it was nearly dark, and I started to light the candles. That was all Jesper needed to make him decide to come and help me. I only just managed to prevent him from pulling the tablecloth, with the decorations and burning candles on top of himself. It needed a lot of coaxing to make him keep away so that I could light the rest of the candles. When all was ready, he came up, tilted his head, looked at the glittering Christmas trees, and then sat down and watched the candles burn lower and lower. As each flame went out, I felt as though another happy day of our life in the camp had passed. When all the lights had gone out, the darkness seemed intense, and as though it were a symbol of the darkness of our future. A few yards away, Elsa and her cubs rested peacefully in the grass, hardly visible in the fading light. Afterwards, George and I read our mail. It took us many hours to do so, during which our imaginations travelled across the world and brought us close to all the people who were wishing Elsa and her family and us happiness. Mercifully, it was one of the last envelopes I opened which contained an order from the African District Council for the removal of Elsa and her cubs from the reserve. The reason given by the council was that since Elsa was used to our company, she might become a danger to other people. We were amazed. The local authorities themselves had helped us to choose the area of her release, and up to now had regarded her as a great asset to the reserve. Now, with the arrival of the deportation order, all we could do was to try to make this removal as little harmful to the lions as possible, and find a satisfactory new home for them. We wrote to friends in Tanganyika, Uganda, the Rhodesias and South Africa, inquiring what the chances were of finding a good territory for the family in their countries, but before finally deciding to remove Elsa and her family from Kenya, George wished to carry out a reconnaissance along the eastern shores of Lake Rudolph. To make the removal, we would first build a ramp and then place a 5-ton lorry against it, so that its floor was level with the top of the ramp. In the lorry, we would place the lion's dinner. Once the cubs had got used to their new feeding place, we would build a strong wire enclosure over the lorry and make a trap door to it, which we would close when the cubs were feeding, thus converting the lorry into a travelling crate. We dug the ramp at the salt lick near the studio. My heart was heavy as I watched the cubs. They were excited by the unusual activities taking place on their playground, sniffed the freshly dug soil curiously, found it great fun to roll on the loose earth, and seemed to think that all this work was done to amuse them. On the 28th of December, George started off on the recce to Lake Rudolph. That afternoon, I met the family near the river, and after the usual friendly greetings from Elsa and Jesper, we went together to the water's edge. The cubs plunged in at once, ducking and chasing each other. Elsa and I watched them from the bank. Eventually, Jesper sat down close to me, turning his back to me. This he did when he wanted to be petted. He seemed to realize that I was always a little afraid of being accidentally scratched by him, because unlike his mother, he had not learned to retract his claws when playing with human beings. On the 2nd of January, Ken Smith and Peter Saw, both game wardens from adjoining districts, arrived in a lorry. They'd come with the consent of the game department to offer their help in moving Elsa and the cubs. Ken took some measurements for fitting the ramp to a 4-wheel-drive Bedford lorry belonging to the government, which he proposed to lend us for the move. He also offered to order a lion-proof wire enclosure to fit it, and to send us our old Thames lorry until the adjustments to the Bedford were completed. This would make it possible for us to accustom the cubs to to feeding in a lorry with a minimum loss of time. Ken had been on the lion hunt which brought Elsa into our life, and had visited her twice since then, but he had never seen the cubs, so after we had dealt with the measurements, we all went off to look for the family. We found them in the studio lugger, but at the sight of two strangers the cubs bolted. Elsa greeted Ken as an old friend, but paid no attention to Peter. As we did not want to upset the cubs, we returned to camp and sent the lorry a few hundred yards down the track. A little later, Elsa arrived alone. She watched us for some time, and then, still ignoring Peter, she gripped Ken firmly round the knee with her paw. We guessed she wanted to show him that she thought it was time for him to go. Ken took the hint, and they left. And immediately the cubs came bouncing along and began to play. This showed us that they were becoming increasingly shy of strangers. Jesper had overcome his suspicion of George and myself, but he didn't trust anyone else. He showed his confidence in me the following day when he allowed me to remove a tick from his eyelid and rid him also of a couple of maggots. These maggots, which are found in great numbers in most game animals, though themselves harmless, weaken the condition of their host and render it susceptible to other illnesses. Jesper kept absolutely still while I attended to his maggots. Then he licked his wounds and placed himself with his back to me, inviting me to pat him. For the first time, he even allowed me to touch his silky nostrils. Perhaps he wanted to show me that he was grateful for my help. That evening, he came alone into the tent, squatted in his safety position and kept quite still until I stroked him. His demands for affection posed a serious problem. I hated to disappoint him, but on the other hand, apart from my fear of his claws, we wanted the cubs to develop into wild lions, and Jesper's friendliness was already jeopardizing his future. The next day, the Thames lorry arrived. We gave it a thorough wash and then parked it at the ramp, but it smelt of petrol and oil, and nothing would persuade the cubs to go near it. Even Elsa would not follow me into it, although I tried every trick I could think of to persuade her, in the belief that her example would encourage the cubs. There was nothing to be done, except to wait until the lions had overcome their suspicion of the lorry, and remind myself that since the cubs so far had never been inside a vehicle, I was asking a lot of them. On the 8th of January, about lunchtime, I heard the excited chatter of baboons coming from the bank opposite the studio. This usually meant that the family were around, so later on I went to the studio lugger with my sketchbook. I found Elsa and her sons there, and as they were very sleepy, I had a splendid opportunity of drawing them. Poor Elsa was infested with maggots, but when I had tried to squeeze them out, she flattened her ears and growled at me, so I was obliged to leave her alone. When it got dark, and there was still no sign of little Elsa, I was anxious, but as her mother did not seem in the least apprehensive, I decided not to worry, for I had discovered that Elsa's instinct was more reliable than mine. I am convinced that when there was a source of danger in the neighbourhood, she had some means of sensing its presence, and also that she had a way, a quite imperceptible way, of transmitting her wishes to her cubs. We often watched attentively for any indication of a visible or audible sign of communication between her and her children, but were never able to observe one. What faculty did she and other highly developed wild animals possess which could account for this? I think perhaps it is the power of telepathy, which we human beings too may have possessed before we developed the capacity to speak. We all returned to camp and gave the lions their dinner. After the meal was over, Elsa suddenly got up, listened intently in the direction of the river, and began to walk towards it. I followed at a short distance. I caught up with her at the water's edge, and in the failing light was just able to see little Elsa pacing up and down on the far bank, evidently frightened to enter the water, which was fairly deep at this point, and where more than once I'd seen a large crocodile. Elsa gave her low, affectionate moan, moving quickly upstream and keeping her eyes fixed on little Elsa as she did so. Along the opposite bank, the cub followed her. When they came to a shallow part of the river, Elsa stopped, and her call changed, and finally her daughter plucked up enough courage to swim across. Later, Elsa came to my tent and rubbed herself affectionately against me, as if to show me how happy she was to have all her family together again, and how pleased she was that the anxiety we had shared was over. It was 6 days since we had placed the lorry by the ramp at the salt lick, and so far as I could judge from the spoor, no lion had been near it. I went into the open truck and called Elsa. After some hesitation, she followed me, but placed herself broadside on to the entrance, thus preventing me from getting out, and Jesper, who was following her, from coming in. After a time, she went back to the tents and hopped onto the roof of the Land Rover. The cubs began to eat, and I went over to their mother and started to play with her. As I did so, I noticed that two of the maggot swellings had gone septic. I wanted to deal with them, but each time I touched her, she withdrew, and when on the following day I again tried to help her, she seemed to be even more sensitive. I always carry a little sulfanilamide powder with me to disinfect insect bites or scratches, but George believes that while they are very effective for human beings, in the case of animals, one should not give such drugs unless there is proof that their own antibodies are not strong enough to effect a natural cure. Because of this, I did not give Elsa sulfanilamide, relying on her natural resistance and thinking that she would lick her wounds clean, as she had often done before when she had been plagued by the maggots. The lions spent the next day in the kitchen lugger, where Nuru and I found them in the afternoon. I sent him off to prepare a carcass at the camp. Elsa managed to keep the cubs away from the goats, even though they were developing an increasing interest in them. Had she not always shown such a cooperative attitude, our peaceful truce could never have been maintained. On this day, too, she showed her usual tact and sense of fair play when the cubs started to ambush me. All they wanted was a friendly game, but their claws were very sharp. Elsa came to my rescue, cuffed her children, gave me too a mild spanking, and generally saw to it that the cubs' surprise at my reluctance to play with them did not develop into animosity. George had now been away for 2 weeks on the recce to Lake Rudolph. He had been joined by Ken Smith, as well as by the game warden for the area. I expected them back any day, but almost dreaded to hear the noise of the car, for I feared it might mean the end of Elsa's happy life. She and her children would need to forget this ideal environment and all that was familiar to them before they could begin to be happy in another place. If man, with all his capacity to reason, often gives tragic proof of his inability to adjust himself to exile, how could one expect wild animals, who are more conservative and more dependent on their territory, to adjust themselves to something completely strange? During the night, I heard the family around the camp, and it was not until after breakfast that they scampered towards the down palm logs beyond the salt lick, where Elsa stood contemplating the lorry. Very soon, she stepped cautiously onto the roof of the cabin and sat down. For 10 days I'd been waiting for her to do just this, but now I felt sad to see her sitting so trustingly on the lorry, which was to take her away from her home. I joined her and tried without success to deal with her maggots. She was licking them, and I hoped this would help to heal the sores quickly. Next afternoon, I found the family in the studio lugger. I had brought my sketchbook, but preferred to sit near Elsa and comfort her by stroking her head. She lay quite still and allowed me to pat her, but when I touched her back or my hand came near one of her sores, she growled. Her nose was wet and cold, a sure sign that she was ill. Two of the wounds were festering, and pus was oozing out of them. I hoped that this meant that they would drain. I still refrained from giving her sulfanilamide so as not to weaken her natural resistance, and I was so convinced that the maggots were responsible for her condition that I never thought of taking a blood slide and having it analysed to see whether she had any other infection. When it got dark, Elsa moved into the bush a few yards away from the lugger, and when I left for camp, she remained there with the cubs, and I did not see her or the cubs again that evening. In the morning, I followed her spoor till I saw the lions on top of Woofing Rock. As I did not want to disturb them, I painted the rock from a distance until a cloudburst put an end to my efforts. In the afternoon I returned, and through my field glasses saw two cubs on the rock. There was no sign of Elsa, and assuming that she and Jesper, though hidden from my view, were close by, I called, but there was no response. The lions did not come to the camp that night. This was not unusual, but I felt worried on account of Elsa's condition, so at first light I went to the rock. There I was relieved to see all the family on the ridge. I called to Elsa, and she raised her head. The cubs didn't move. At tea time, I went back with Nuru. Elsa at once came out of the bush below the rock, followed by Jesper. She greeted me affectionately, but I noticed that she was breathing heavily, and that every movement seemed to require an effort. Jesper acted like a bodyguard, and made it difficult for me to stroke her. I sat close to her till Gopa and little Elsa joined us, and then we started for home. Elsa was very impatient with the cubs, and evidently extremely sensitive to being touched. She did not object to my walking beside her and flicking off the tsetse flies, but she got really angry when one of the cubs tried to prod her. I'd never before seen her react like this. She sat down repeatedly during the short distance through the bush to the car track, but after we reached the track, the going was easier. When we got to the camp, she went straight to the Land Rover and lay down on the roof very carefully to avoid putting pressure on her sores. I brought her some marrow, a thing she loved, but she only looked at it and turned away, and when I tried to stroke her paws, she moved them out of my reach. Soon it would be 4 weeks since we had received the deportation order, and it was already 3 since George had gone on his recce to Lake Rudolph. Before he left, we had planned to start the move on the 20th of January. Today was the 19th. Never once had the cubs entered the Thames lorry. The Bedford had not arrived. Elsa was ill. We had not yet found a new home for the cubs or a way of moving them. Plainly, we were going to be far behind our schedule. That evening, George arrived, but his news was not good. He and Ken Smith, driving the 2 Land Rovers and a lorry, had first gone to Alia Bay, immediately north of the Longandoti Hills. Alia Bay was the place to which we had taken Elsa on the foot safari. From this range, some secluded valleys ran down to Lake Rudolph, and it was one of the areas in which George hoped that we might find a suitable home for Elsa and the cubs. Up to now, no one had ever reached these valleys by motor, so the first need was to find a possible route. George made a pretty comprehensive recce, and his opinion was that Moita offered the only hope, and this only if he could find or make a passable track to it and get permission to rent some land there. Before returning to Isiolo, he discussed with the district commissioner of Massabit the possibility of leasing some land round Moita, and asked for his cooperation to build a 60-mile road and clear the ground for an airstrip. The district commissioner gave his consent. We, of course, were to provide the necessary cash. Since the sum involved was considerable, George said he would wait to take a decision until he had discussed the matter with me. The prospect of settling the lions near Lake Rudolph seemed very unsatisfactory to me, so I was much relieved that in the mail which George had picked up on his way to camp, we found letters from the Rhodesias, Bechuanaland, and South Africa in reply to our inquiries, all offering alternative possibilities. Since we had no idea whether the ecological conditions in these areas would be suitable for our lions, George suggested that I should go at once to Nairobi and ask the advice of Major Ian Grimwood, our chief game warden, who knew the localities well. If he should consider them unsuitable, then I would telegraph to the district commissioner at Massabit, asking him to start work at once. During my absence, George would train the cubs to feed in the Bedford, which was due to arrive, complete with wiring closure within a few days. As there was so little time left, I agreed to go, provided that Elsa was well enough for me to leave her. Early next morning, we waded to the opposite bank and found the family a few yards from the water. Elsa broke through the dense undergrowth and rubbed herself affectionately against me. I scratched her on the head and behind the ears. Her coat was like velvet,